You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 22nd of December, 2021, heading into the home stretch of the new calendar, Christmas. Fewer and fewer homes seem to be decorated anymore. And those that are decorated are usually so bad and gaudy that it's worthless, especially with these ridiculous inflatables. They never look good. Thank God, in the weird colors. It's a bizarre situation. I'm also going to do a bit of fundraising today on my own behalf. So we come to the end of the year, the Christmas season. I need your help in every possible way. As I'm working on two books, roughly 75 articles, and these broadcasts that often take, it's taken many years, all told to put together. I'm going to keep doing this for as long as I'm alive. I don't know how to do anything else. I don't have a end date for the books. One on China as a nationalist power, rather than a communist one, and then of course the book on nominalism, which is slowly getting attention even before it's published. So whatever you can do through my PayPal, I do appreciate. And everything, every penny I raise goes to, you know, these expenses of having to function in a dying society. The good news is that I need very little. And for those of you who have donated to me, I appreciate it. And for those of you who can't do what I do, for whatever reason, who can't be in the spotlight, who can't be public, who can't use your real name, who can't, you know, there's too much at stake, you can still be an activist by supporting those of us who are. And I understand that some people are in difficult situations, and it's going to get more difficult, but by supporting me financially, you, in fact, are on the front lines. The overarching narrative of the news media today is phantasmagoric in its absurdity about war with Russia, which of course I've been predicting since the late 90s, that Russia is the only country that has the ability to stand in the way of what we used to call the New World Order, now the Great Reset of the BlackRock monopoly. And now, President Xi has said the formal alliance between Russia and China has been made clear. That also includes Iran and Pakistan, and to a great extent, believe it or not, India. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Any shooting war that develops, you're going to see a falling away of NATO allies. Germany will have nothing to do with it. France will have nothing to do with it. Central Europe will have nothing to do with their pro-NATO governments. No one's going to die for BlackRock. The stories of some kind of Russian aggression, they've been talking about a Russian invasion of Ukraine since 2004. No one's ever seen it. Now, we do know that American defense contractors and uniformed officers have been in Ukraine setting up a possible chemical weapons false flag, like they did in Syria. They're not very original, these people. And that they're building a Ukrainian military that, of course, really can't function. The country's a fourth world economic status, and yet they're building a navy, the most expensive thing a military can put together. Bringing Ukraine into NATO would be ridiculously expensive. Because to be a member of NATO, you would have to have total interchangeability of equipment and methods, which certainly is nowhere. I mean, it would be $1 trillion before that's the case. But NATO has absorbed states that have no right to be in it just for the sake of having more members. Albania is a NATO member, despite not really having a military. So this is a way of, like, bringing Bulgaria into the EU just to make sure it doesn't go into the Russian orbit, even though it has none of the prerequisites of being an EU member. And speaking of the Navy, I spent quite a while talking about the fact that the U.S. is not a first-grade military power. The U.S. by far does not have the world's greatest military. And it's really a history of failures. The Navy, as far as the seafaring powers are concerned, and I'm taking an article from Russia Insider, a very good author, who is absolutely, you know, who understands these things at great length. Dmitry Orlov. And a lot of these things, and he's written several articles on this topic, several articles on the inability of the U.S. to project military power abroad. You still have a general prejudice. The Americans have a military that's capable, really, of functioning competently, and it simply doesn't exist. So, anyway, globalization, the spread of the debt economy throughout the world, is really based on the Navy. And without it, such a system can't function. And, of course, the U.S. is no different in this respect. The United States uses its naval power, and again, being the most expensive and advanced part of the military, only a handful of countries could put a functional navy together. This was the core of the British Empire, and to a great extent that of the Netherlands and Portugal centuries ago. It's a means of projecting power pretty much anywhere. But over the last 60 years, with the addition, of course, of air power, the carrier fleet and this massive network of military bases has been the core of Washington's promotion of the global homo liberal agenda on the planet. This is the Pax Americana. And he rightly states that it's this brief period between the fall of the USSR in 1990 to the rise of Russia and China as the barriers against global liberalism not that long ago. So the American Empire, to a great extent, and I'm going to quote him directly. By using its naval power to dominate the sea lanes that carried crude oil, and by insisting that oil be traded in U.S. dollars, the U.S. was able to live beyond its means by issuing dollar-denominated debt instruments and forcing countries around the world to invest in them. It imported whatever it wanted using borrowed money while exporting inflation, expropriating the savings of peoples across the world. In the process, the U.S. has accumulated absolutely stunning levels of national debt beyond anything ever seen before, in either absolute or relative terms. When this debt bomb finally explodes, it will spread economic devastation far beyond U.S. borders, and it will explode once the petrodollar wealth pump imposed on the world through American naval and air superiority stops working. Now, I've dealt with the economic aspect of this, especially on Thursdays, the Daily Nationalist, on a pretty regular basis. Getting into the more technical aspects of international finance. But I also made the claim a long time ago that the carrier-based system of naval military projection is obsolete. And at a roundtable recently, I talked about the new hypersonic weapons, missile systems of Russia, far superior to anything that exists in the U.S. The Zircon hypersonic cruise missile, and they'll be delivered to the Navy in 2022. It travels five times the speed of sound in the upper atmosphere. And because of its hypersonic glide, it allows it to maneuver toward a target or away from its defenses. It's very difficult to touch. But these new missiles, China has their own version of this, very long range, make the carrier system obsolete. Russia's missiles, you know, long range, can be, you know, launched from 1,000 miles away, unstoppable. It just takes one to sink a destroyer, a couple to sink an aircraft carrier, as he would say. So you could sink the American Navy without having a Navy yourself. And he makes the claim, as rationally, that defense budgets now don't matter. Even the technical edge has shifted to the Russians. The Russians can build more hypersonic missiles far more quickly than the U.S. can build carriers. And despite that, of course, the U.S. is still sticking to the carrier system. For years, I've talked about the air defense capability of Russia, the S-400 and S-500 systems. In a word, it can seal off a country's airspace. So it was deployed in Syria, which is what kind of sealed it off from Israeli attacks. It doesn't take long to come to the conclusion that the naval and air superiority of the U.S. is disintegrating. And using massed infantry is not something it's capable of doing, not something it will do, nor is it something they could do competently. So it seems then the nuclear option has been discussed for the first time in a long time. When there was the USSR, it was condemned beyond belief. Now, when it's a nationalist Russia, it's completely acceptable. And promoted even by leftists. So, you know, this is a completely, what they say, game changing as far as international political economy is concerned. And at this point, well, there's a few facts when we talk about any confrontation in this sense. You have the huge landmass and wealth of the Russian Federation, oil, gas, uranium, coal, the rest of it. Our Russian experienced military has been around the planet. You have, 20 or 40 million Russians living outside the country. You have a country that's now completely protected by its missile system from any attack. And now you have, as several others, Kolmogorov and many others have made the claim, that now you have a fully ethno-nationalist movement and president in the country. Now, given that fact, we'll get to that, we'll go back to that here in a minute. The real purpose of American military adventures in that part of the world is to make war on nationalism. Anatoly Karlin, who's a first-rate author on these topics, has divided up Putin's three terms as kind of, you know, the first being early on non-ideological technical centralization, the second the conservative turn, and the third the national turn. Before we get into the military aspects of things, it's important to talk about what the target really is. Russian nationalists are free to function now in a way that they weren't before. Article 282 has largely been defanged, and there were some ridiculous prosecutions for a few of them, but, you know, so-called hate speech, which doesn't exist. In 2018, Putin completely removed the teeth in 282. And you have nationalist coffee shops, you have bookstores, you have self-defense organizations, throughout the country. And the focus now is large families and Russians as an ethnic group here. Immigration reform, as he's explained in depth, including repatriation. And, you know, foreigners have to be skilled. They have to provide something. And don't forget, you know, from Central Asia, so many of those immigrating to Russia aren't third worlders. Northern Kazakhstan is Russian to a great extent. Putin has made it clear that Russians and Ukrainians are one people. And he has a very lengthy, very good article on the topic. So the immigration reforms, you have roughly maybe 100,000 new citizens from countries in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. From that period of time, 2018. But Sweden issued 80,000 in 2020. You know, so issuing new citizenship in Russia is very low. And so the immigration policy is getting stricter and more difficult for the third worlders. And you have Russians coming in from Ukraine, Russians coming in from Central Asia, and creating a more centralized ethnic system. Carlin's article on this topic, which is called Russia's Nationalist Turn, How Putin Created the Russian National State, is detailing things that I've been saying for a very long time. He has, you know, a very different view now on the Donbass situation, as the Ukrainians may be considering a military offensive with American mercenaries, and which is exactly why the Russian military was moved to dissuade the Zelensky system from attempting any operation. The Donbass states that I've been talking about for a long time have declared themselves Russian nation states. The doctrine of the Russian Donbass, which I have quoted several times recently, says that Russia is the only historical state of the Russian nation. And the point of their rebellion against liberal Ukraine was to join with Russia. And you had a situation, according to him, where, you know, pro-Russian dissidents from Ukraine were getting deported back. But that's been halted. Putin has personally intervened in that respect. United Russia, which is the main political party, is cooperating fully with the Union of Donbass Veterans. And they even make it clear that they're securing the Russian world language and genetic code. So this is just the beginning. You have a national ethnic state that's being built. He talks about Lenin being a German agent as a normal public school topic, the annexation of Crimea as an exercise of moral responsibility. It wasn't that long ago you had liberal textbooks in schools. Those have been removed. In 2020, the Constitution itself said that marriage is between a man and a woman. The Russian soul is tethered to the conversion to orthodoxy 1,000 years ago. And here you have, you know, you don't have Antifa of any size. You don't have, you know, the sexual revolution being promoted everywhere. You have thousands of churches now being restored in huge numbers. He mentions Igor Rudny in Tver, who drove out, who was the governor, drove out Tajik laborers who were illegal from his province and he instituted something called the Ministry of Demographic and Family Policy in 2019. This was an ethnic-based idea. He created the family farmstead and building the large family, building the agrarian idea. That's just one example. Rebuilding the countryside is connected with rebuilding these churches. And he also points to a greater turn to nationalism amongst the youth. The 2018 election seemed to suggest. There were those sporadic attacks on nationalist movements, which were very ill-advised, but they are now gone, as I've mentioned. You have a firmly national policy, with the one exception, of course, of the vaccine obsession, which is extremely difficult to reconcile with any of this. Now, it's true you don't have the massive lockdown and double masking, and it's argued that the Sputnik V is one of the most effective vaccines. But Russia is one of the least vaccinated countries in the world. And believe it or not, he reports that the Communist Party is the least likely to be vaccinated. And of course, the church has condemned this policy entirely, any kind of vaccine mandate, even going so far as to suggest that because of the genetic component, it alters the image of God in the individual who's getting injected with it. So you have a nationalist culture, youth, the church, that now is a matter of policy. And you know, for a country that has lost, you know, tens of millions of people since 1936. And the slaughters of these wars and starvation. You've rebuilt, he's helped rebuild a country of extraordinary resilience. Seventh largest economy in the world, now attached to the largest economy in the world, which is China. Now, that being said, and many of you know that I've been, you know, talking about that for a million years, and now is almost becoming mainstream in certain circles in the West, the military situation has to be dealt with. I've said 1,000 times that the U.S. can't win a war, period, let alone with a major military power that's motivated. But yet this is what the West is continuing to demand. Ukraine is constantly provoking Russia with Western backing. You have 8 million Russians living in Ukraine who are second-class citizens with Russian media banned officially. Russia is still Ukraine's by far number one trading partner. As I've said, you have several polls now that if half the population, including in the West, including the older population, and the younger population as well, all ages, having positive views of Russia and Russian history. And as I mentioned, Putin has a lengthy article on the unity of the Russian-Ukrainian people. Now, beyond all that, the military situation is not affected by any Western sanctions. Russia banned different kinds of food imports from the EU. All that meant was it increased the rural economy in Russia. Russia is now self-sufficient in food. And then EU farmers, of course, being pretty powerful in Europe, those sanctions hurt politicians very badly. The U.S. wants to sanction Russian energy imports in Europe, which would force the Europeans to buy from the Americans. The supplies then would have to come across the ocean. They'd be far more expensive. They're far less reliable. And this is the reason that the French and the Germans want nothing to do with this imperial ideology. Their sovereignty has long since surrendered. Russia has no interest in any kind of expansion, except where there is Russian citizens. But sovereign nations is at the core of the Russian idea. The Baltic states, just like Ukraine, is constantly talking about that Russia's on the verge of invasion. This has been a weekly statement for a long time. NATO is simply a part of the American military-industrial complex. It's a financial institution. But when you have new missile technology, when you have the defeat of the U.S. machine in Afghanistan, which I predicted, the backing of the U.S. doesn't seem to mean much anymore. During the Syrian war, and I reported on this, a very, very long-range missile hit was done. I forget how long, 1,000 miles, and smashed an ISIS position in Syria. That was done to impress. This is extremely significant. The hypersonic system means that there is no advantage to the U.S. Technological edge. Now, I wrote an article, some of you may know this, on the U.S. Navy, because this is what's being moved into the Black Sea, this is what's in the South China Sea. It's called The Collapse of the U.S. Navy and the Real Size of the Defense Budget. And I make the claim here, the U.S. is not a superpower, it does not have military dominance, and it doesn't have a strong military in general. It seems that every week there's a new military disaster. The Air Force, just in 2019, the Air Force crashed one jet after another. One slammed into a California warehouse. In June of 2019, the USS Fitzgerald, the destroyer, collided with a cargo ship in Tokyo. In August, USS John McCain crashed into an oil tanker in Singapore. And the head of the 7th Fleet, Vice Admiral Oikoin, was fired. He was fired for blatant incompetence. The Navy investigated and said these were avoidable accidents. Oikoin said that the Navy would begin a deliberate reset of its ships in the Pacific, retooling and even retraining, having to go over the assessment of each vessel. So the U.S. Navy is not confident of its own ships anymore. I mean, here's just a few. Going back a few years, August 21st, 2017, guided missile destroyer collided with a civilian oil tanker, which, by the way, damaged the destroyer more than anything else. 10 sailors were killed. June 17, 2017, South China Sea, another guided missile destroyer collided with a cargo ship. Southwest of Usoka in Japan, January 31st, 2017. Another cruiser ran aground while trying to anchor and damaged its propeller. There was no injury, but it put the ship out of service. In the same place, in September of 2016, an unmanned undersea vehicle sank after colliding with a military Sealift Command vessel. The Atlantic in August 2016, following a routine strategic deterrence mission, a nuclear missile sub and another military Sealift Command vessel collided. I mean, it goes on and on. It seems that every month there's another disaster. 2014, in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, a dock landing craft collided with a buoy that navigated in the Thimble Shoals Channel. In February 2014, a guided missile frigate ran aground while entering the waters of Samsun, Turkey, causing damage to the ship's propeller again. November 16, 2013, a drone crashed into a guided missile cruiser during training in Southern California. January 17, an anti-mine ship ran aground, 2013, while operating in the Sulu Sea near the Philippines. October 13, 2012, a cruiser collided with a submarine off the coast of Florida, Jacksonville. August 12, 2012, a destroyer, which was coming into the Arabian Gulf, collided with yet another tanker. May 16, 2012, a marine assault ship collided with another military Sealift Command oil unit during refueling near South California. In 2012, a special operations craft smashed into a fishing boat, killing a bunch of local fishermen in the Philippine Sea. Yeah, this is just, I'm talking about a few years here. And it happens, and this is just the ones that get reported. Most of the time, these aren't reported. These are humiliating for the so-called world's greatest military. These are the few that get reported. Many of these are hushed up. It's not an accident, and it's not an exaggeration to say that the Navy has reached a crisis point. The Navy has shrunk from 600 ships to 275 over the last 30 years, despite threatening every major power in the world. The Trump administration wanted to, and Biden's a different administration, wants to build more ships and increasing the number of aircraft carriers to 12, despite them being completely irrelevant anymore. So the Navy is overworked. There's far more demand of it, with now fewer and fewer ships to do it. And this explains the incompetence, the disasters. The U.S. has taken on countless foreign commitments while dropping ships, planes, and men. The budget keeps going up. The military failures get more and more embarrassing. So this political posturing, delusional belief about being a superpower, have overstretched the Navy and endangered lives. So when you massively increase commitments while cutting the fleet substantially, you're going to have problems. Now, this isn't just my opinion. This is accepted by the Navy as a crisis. And I've said it in a few other places, but in the early 2000s, the Navy eliminated training for junior officers as they went to their assignments. Now, they're the officers with whom the upper brass entrust the operation of vital tasks aboard ship. They used to spend a long time at the Surface Warfare Officer School. They studied navigation, engineering, and weaponry. But that's been shut down. Officers now are given a stack of computer disks sent to sea and said, in your spare time, you'll learn it yourself. And there's no oversight to this training, which means the Navy is self-taught. Now, there was some partial restoration of this in 2008. But the disaster, the crisis of the Navy, is now official doctrine. The Davidson Report confirms everything that I've been saying. The Navy is simply out of gas. Forces are not being trained. Ships aren't being maintained. The number of ships continue to drop, although the exact number changes all the time. It's a drop of quality and quantity. The demand for the Navy's presence have grown due to both political and economic concerns for Israel, for example, or global capital. Something called the Optimal Manning Initiative was implemented by the Navy between 2003-2012. The point was to reduce crew sizes in an attempt to lower costs. Now, the initiative failed because the increased maintenance costs canceled out any lower personnel costs. Not to mention eliminating training. It was a disaster. Even this common sense inevitability is beyond the cognitive reach of the military. Constant war is expensive. Operating and support costs increased during the initiative period and continued to rise, according to the GAO. The Davidson Report noted, obviously, that the shortfalls, quote, can contribute to crew fatigue and crew endurance. The Davidson Report agrees completely with everything I'm saying here. The Navy is trying to do more with less. The Davidson Report found that, I'm quoting here, operational requirements gradually took precedence over training and maintenance and resulted in decisions to employ ships that have not been given the time to train and certify in all required mission areas. And the reason for this, that American foreign policy will not adjust to reality. Delusions have serious consequences. Dozens of admirals were retired forcibly when Obama left office. And it's still going on. Any of those replacing them certainly will not say no to anyone in power, or they sit in their very fragile positions. You have chaos at the top. This explains a lot. The Davidson Report states also that training for officers was too dependent on on-the-job training. And a lot of this propaganda that American opponents are too primitive to fight back successfully is, old and doesn't work. Chaos at the top removal of training, affirmative action. Liberalism as an official ideology now has destroyed the American military industry. The U.S. military reports low readiness levels. The Navy says that this is because deployment lengths are growing, meeting the continuing high demand for ships. So, for example, the deployment length for carrier strike groups increased from an average of almost 7 months from 2008 to 2011 to almost a year for the three that were deployed in 2015. Now, I've mentioned the carriers several times before, and it's a psychological symbol. It's, I spoke about the marriage of the sea ritual in Republican Venice, the connection of the sea power, global commerce, usury, in the Renaissance. The aircraft carrier is a continuation of it. Everyone knows they're ridiculously expensive. They take up almost half the Navy's personnel. But in this same report, the claim that I've made is worse than the claim I made. Two-thirds of the Navy's strike fighters can't fly. Keeping aircraft carriers in service means taking from other ships, making a bad situation worse. So the Navy is trying to shift part of funding for new ships after delivery so as to hide the severity of cost overruns. So the lifespan of a carrier is like 50 years, but with overuse, that's going to be lower. And half the carrier systems are reaching old age anyway. But the carrier system is still the dominant Navy model. They could operate close to a shoreline without fear. As I've stated several times, the sophisticated new anti-ship missiles are rendering that obsolete. Any kind of attack using a carrier, the fleet will have to defend against large numbers of incoming weapons, very evasive trajectories, now five times the speed of sound. And the attacker only has to score a few hits. The Andrew Erickson of the U.S. Naval War College said these new missiles put U.S. forces on the wrong side of physics, meaning that the carriers will have to function far offshore, almost to the point where it's out of range. Well, the war games and the simulations since 2002 have all predicted the mass sinking of aircraft carriers. This is why the USSR and Russia never really invested in them. They were sitting ducks. In March of, I forget what year it was, the French Navy reported that sunk the USS Theodore Roosevelt and half of his escorts in a war game. But they removed that from its website. I think it was 2002. All these war games and simulations show a disaster for the U.S. military and U.S. Navy in particular. The Chinese developed its DF-26 missiles, deployed into Inner Mongolia, 3,000-mile range, satellite-targeted, and it's been moved deep into the interior of the country because it makes it more difficult to intercept and outside of American radar range. So the American SM-6 defense system has a range of about 150 miles, which means it can only really be effective at the last few seconds of the missile's flight, which is the most difficult phase to hit anything. The Navy has admitted over and over again that it doesn't have any real defense against these weapons. And the Russian Kinzhal, the KH-47M2, is even superior to that. The point is, the Navy has this bizarre symbol of American dominance being brought into the Black Sea, as if somehow that's going to intimidate anybody, is a paper tiger. The Congressional Budget Office released comparing a 355-ship fleet with smaller naval forces and said that it would be 2047 would be the only reasonable time for that to actually be reached. The Navy would have to purchase 330 ships over the next 30 years at a rate of $30 billion a year if the fleet is grown through this new ship construction, or if life extension programs are included. So the average cost of shipbuilding would amount to at least 160% of what the Navy allocates for this kind of thing. It's going to take a very long time to build any kind of functional Navy now. Neither Obama or Trump proposed any kind of budget that is commensurate with sustaining any expanded fleet whatsoever. The Navy is non-functional. As of May 2019, China has more warships than the U.S., and they are more modern, they are newer than the Americans. 300 surface ships, 23 destroyers, and we'll have two aircraft carriers. So that means more for China than the 11 or so carrier does for the U.S. China doesn't have to patrol the oceans of the world. The crisis is so bad, former Defense Secretary James Mattis tried to gag all discussions of these failures in the press. I spoke about all the crashes and disasters. Well, the Military Times, which is a publication, went through thousands of records to find that military aircraft crashes have soared by 40% since 2013. When steep cuts to defense spending, known as sequestration, led to a shortfall of training and spare parts. Well, there are no steep cuts to defense. Defense spending has long been over $1 trillion, since on-budget expenditure is only a small part of the story. Now, the Pentagon has denied that they were gagged during the Trump administration. But they're not exactly going to deny, and haven't denied, the problem of readiness. And talking about this stuff will give aid and comfort to the enemy. Despite that, you're still pouring trillions of billions of dollars into new ships and aircraft carriers, despite their obsolescence. Talking about a war on at least two fronts, and again, using more exact numbers, October 2018, half of the Navy FA-18 Super Hornets were flyable, and 31% were fully ready to deploy at a moment's notice. Really, back then, 2019, 62% of the FA-18s were inoperable due to maintenance issues. Head of Naval Aviation, Troy Shoemaker, says that the readiness level has been declining for the last few years. He said this in his testimony to Congress. The militaries of China and Russia can be larger and more technically advanced than the U.S. at a fraction of the price, because they don't have to finance hundreds of overseas bases to fight multiple losing wars at once. The Military Times, which is a semi-official publication, repeats the claim, and I don't know how they do this, that there's cuts to defense spending. There's no cuts to defense spending whatsoever. The Navy is struggling due to budget cuts, despite the fact that real defense spending is over $1 trillion. In fact, I've put it together at $1.1 trillion as of 2019, and they're claiming that they're being cut. Now, I might have mentioned this before, but you have a legal cap. In 2020, the Defense Department's base budget was legally capped at $576 billion by the Budget Control Act of 2011. So today's budgets actually aren't really legally plausible. And one of the ways that we know it's over $1 trillion is the use of the Overseas Operation Fund, which isn't traceable. It's not part of the budget, like everything else at the Pentagon. There's no control over how the money is spent. There's no auditing. It's exempt from the Budget Control Act law. The Government Accounting Office says that Congress shifted almost $2 trillion into the OCO since 2001. As of 2021, there was about $200 billion in that fund, as far as anyone knows. So budget control legislation and even official numbers, as far as the American military budget is concerned, are worthless. at the end of the Trump administration, he wanted another $200 billion for that fund. So you have entire programs, like the Army's allotments for ammunition and training, will be moved to the OCO, and hence not legally traceable. And Trump actually attacked Obama for using this fund. And let me quote the Cato Institute here in this respect. The United States spends more than twice as much on its military as China and Russia combined, and is clearly the world's preeminent military power. But it isn't obvious that we're getting the biggest bang for our buck, and whether this additional spending will be crucial to sustaining our edge. More to the point, even with all this preeminence, the U.S. military has struggled to bring current conflicts to a satisfactory end. As noted in 2016 by Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, we're zero for a lot. Military historian Andrew Havich similarly concludes, having been at war for virtually the entire 21st century, the United States military is still looking for its first win. Now, the Cato Institute, this is a very, very bizarre thing to say. The U.S. is not the world's preeminent military power. There is no edge. But when you have Admiral Mullen saying, you know, and the phrase, you know, if you say you're 0 for 5, 0 for 10, he says we're 0 for a lot. The wars the U.S. has been involved with in the 21st century have all been failures. But of course, ideology is destroying what functionality the military has. I remember back in 1990 when the women in combat issue was first invented, as if combat is some sort of right that the state gets to dole out. People want to avoid combat roles. That's why the draft exists. No women are screaming to pick up a rifle. The issue was invented in the New York Times in 1990, has no roots in military science at all. When the bullets start flying, there is a huge sudden spike in pregnancy. And sexual activity among mixed soldiers is very, very high. Going to their trenches is not exactly a privilege. People want to avoid fighting. In February of 2020, military.com, which is an official publication, said this. The Marine Corps top general wants to see more female officers leading infantry battalions and will consider bringing back women who left active duty if they're willing to serve in ground combat jobs that were once open only to men. Commandant General David Berger said Friday that he wants to see more active-duty female company-grade officers volunteering to attend the infantry officer course and assigned to infantry battalions if they complete it. The course, known to be one of the service's most grueling, prepares officers to lead grunts in combat. Berger also wants officials to determine feasibility of identifying and recruiting for return-to-active-duty selected female Marines to fill jobs that were previously closed to women. The Marine Corps has a hard time getting female volunteers for some of these military occupational specialties. This is a ridiculous invented issue. That this is the policy, this is their big concern. The Marines have nothing to do with such a policy. But when you have a commandant talking like this, you're talking about a destruction of readiness. To get one of these jobs, you have to be a political liberal. Women do not have the strength, the acuity, or testosterone to do these kind of jobs. So the physical tests, the grueling tests, have to be rewritten. And the standards lower for them to become Marine. So the same article continues, even though two women completed the infantry officer course, neither was leading infantry platoons as of June. The Marine Corps Times reported last year, Berger announced the effort to get women serving in these roles on Twitter late last week. It was one of several new initiatives he announced on social media, including a possible move towards year-long paid maternity leave policies for new moms and updated parental leave for same-sex adoptive parents. This is a priority, according to the Marine Corps Times, for the Commandant of the Marine Corps. It's as if they're distracting themselves from lost wars, the corruption, the fraud, the waste, and the metal inflation of the last 20 years. The Commandant of the Marine Corps actually referred to these as, quote, some of my most important matters for immediate execution. Now, if you go to the comment section in that article, it's brimming with contempt for the Marine brass. A lot of them being former Marines. And some seem to be active duty. And I don't think they're laymen because their language is too specialized. Morale has reached rock bottom because of all this. You have Marines led by a female 03 a political appointee that can't even do the proper marches or lift the required weight. Screaming and overcompensating, creating contempt in the unit. Very few women can do 20 runs in full gear. None can do the punishment run. That was one of the comments in that article. This is a failed idea, which is almost a form of deflection from military failure. 25 years ago, at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, both men and women had to perform the same task, carry a pack of more than 100 pounds, climb over barriers, head on a patrol, drop and shoot at targets. After the first week, nearly half the women in the infantry unit dropped out. And they dropped out due to stress fractures in their hips and legs. But, you know, the average female Army recruit is 5 inches shorter and 30 pounds lighter than the male. 40 fewer pounds of muscle. They're not built for this kind of thing. So they lower standards. And this is just one issue, and the racial issue, the sexual issue, where readiness is being deliberately destroyed. Naval aviation, despite its disastrous state, is now 35% female. Even on the carriers, it's 20%. It's one of the reasons the U.S. has two operational carriers out of 11. Because you have thousands of single mothers claiming they can't go out to sea due to their commitments. And because when you have 35% females on carriers, and they're pregnant, or they have small children, the ship doesn't sail. So the purpose of the issue, really, the women in combat and the trainees and all this, ultimately it's to populate the military with women who really have no right to be there. The point would be to have a line of defense against right-wing officers getting too uppity. Any officers that are too right-wing could be drummed out with an anonymous accusation from any one of the so-called victims. The left is always afraid that the military is a breeding ground for right-wingers. Especially at the grunt level, it probably is. So having plenty of liberal women and homosexuals around will expose and destroy this pretty quickly. But even, you know, the purging of the upper levels of the officer corps still occurred under the Trump administration. And there's so much chaos at the top, no one's quite sure who to obey at any point. You think of all this stuff put together, and massive advances in Russian weaponry, the alliance between Russia and China, and the fact that the U.S. is totally bankrupt, American claims of American threats against China and Russia over Ukraine are hollow and nonsensical. You take all these issues together and you have a recipe for failure. You actually have, not a recipe for failure, you have failure. Few people have bothered to note that when you have a Navy that has a huge cohort of female officers or female sailors, you have this spike in pregnancy whenever a war is, whenever they're being deployed in a combat situation. It can't go, it can't sail. Very few people have bothered to note this. The Russians have absolutely nothing to fear in this case. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been lost. I predicted this in 2018. I also wrote an article where they've inflated their use of medals. It's a way to maintain the male ego, given these defeats. The Air Force issued 2,000 Bronze Stars from 2000 to 2004, almost 3,000. Exactly zero of these people were in danger of death. Medal inflation has been an issue of mine for a while. And it got started where the Bronze Star controversy, where you have manpower shortages, you know, officer salaries are sky high, and medals are being given for very minor achievement. affirmative action has taken its toll, that receiving a, you know, receiving these doesn't mean much. Two women who had no connection to combat operations were granted the Bronze Star because they did their job without any problems. Being female was their accomplishment. This is the actual announcement for getting the medal. She distinguished herself by notorious achievement as the NCO in charge during a 365-day deployment, January 2011, January 2012. While in Afghanistan, she accurately executed operational funds across 8 remote bases, providing commanders with flexibility in support of counterinsurgency efforts. Her name was Gomez. Treated 68 operational fund teams, reviewed 34 projects, and funded 280 joint acquisition board packages, enabling critical base sustainment. She was in the accounting office, is what that means. And she gets a Bronze Star. The Air Force quickly removed that from its website once they came under attack. And she was lionized by the Air Force brass. People thought it was satire at first. And I thought maybe the medal inflation would get more mainstream press attention. But it's something where you have, medals being, people being bent over backwards with medals that would not have existed in Vietnam or Korea in World War II. This huge number of medals being given for very little. These medals, proportionally speaking, are granted to officers. You know, the Bronze Star is meant for grunts, taking fire. But all officers receive the Bronze Star 9 times more frequently than grunts do. And they're given for non-combat roles. And this is one of the things that, you know, the Daily Press says, besides giving Kosovo Bronze Stars to people in Missouri, Ohio, and Washington, D.C., the Air Force awarded the medal to servicemen and servicewomen in Italy. And 4 Navy Bronze Star winners stationed in Naples, Italy, ran a great risk of being run over by a motor scooter than being hit by enemy fire. So in other words, an airman, although it's all, in all branches, sit behind a desk for 30 years and have a chest full of medals and ribbons as a result. And this is one of the ways that the U.S. is dealing with its failures, dealing with the destruction of morale, is by pinning medals on themselves. Combat medals are being offered to those who had no combat roles whatsoever. Stars and Stripes reviewed 185 Air Force Bronze Star citations concerning the Yugoslav War and found out that they were given to troops that were stationed in Italy, England, and Spain, having nothing to do with the war in Yugoslavia. But they're considered combat medals. Nor was there any real fighting in Yugoslavia regardless. So you have a military that's falling apart. You have a military that has no vision. You have a military that, whose officers are insanely overpaid. A $1 trillion budget. A navy that's literally falling apart. I mean, physically falling apart. Increasingly female domination in the officer ranks, which means a great degree of unpredictability, especially in the navy. And that's just the beginning. Again, this is why the threats of military action around the world are hollow. This is why no one fears the American Navy, especially. If you went through the full list of these crashes and these disasters, it is embarrassing, and it's going up sometimes 40 or 50% over the last few years. Training has gone by the wayside. Training has actually disappeared in some cases. And since standards are lower, and ideology has taken its place, ideology is more important than actual effectiveness, the U.S. is a paper tiger, as I've said many times before. Metal inflation is just a way to soothe the conscience, to make everyone feel like a participation trophy anymore. Getting a Bronze Star for running the computer printer in Italy during the Yugoslav crisis. It's a joke. And it's important to remember this as the U.S. threatens the world, especially Russia, with its military apparatus. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.